hailing frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
Are you out of your mind?
Watch and learn. This is going to be awesome.
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
You are Starfleet to the core. I can smell it on you.
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
Do we need a mutiny today to prove who we are?
Now, on with the show.
We've only just begun.
Welcome, everyone, to That Star Trek Podcast on the Infinite Potato Alliance Network. Tonight, we're discussing... What?
I just realized, did anyone tell Jen we were recording tonight? Didn't even think of it. I forgot we were doing this tonight until you until you texted, you know, an hour ago. Okay. Well.
I reached out to Neek, but she couldn't do it. Or she hadn't replied. I don't even know if she saw the message.
Hello, my name is Archibald, the AI assistant to the Infinite Potato Alliance. Neek Yeager did not see John's message in time to record with everyone else, but she was able to hear the conversation later and record her thoughts about it. Her words have been interwoven into the episode.
Tonight we'll be discussing Strange New Worlds, episode number 8, The Elysian Kingdom, written by Onitra Johnson and Akilah Cooper, and directed by Amanda Rowe. I am John Irons, and on the show with me tonight are Chris.
Hello, sir. I was taking a drink. Thank you very much for calling on me. You could even see me doing it.
It's fine. And Rick.
What ho, varlets?
Okay. Are you going to just...
I'm not going to do that all night.
You going to embody every characterization from every episode?
No, that's all I did. That's all I'm going to do tonight.
All right. So the IMDb description of this episode says the USS Enterprise becomes stuck in a nebula that is home to an alien consciousness that traps the crew in a fairy tale.
Spoiler.
I mean,
not from us. I mean, that's a huge spoiler for them to put in the freaking description on the webpage.
I suppose.
Not that any Star Trek fan who's seen more than three episodes wouldn't get it within the first 5 minutes, but still.
Well, and yeah, this is definitely a spoiler filled show in general. So if you are if you have not seen the episode, do not listen to those podcasts.
Well, no. I'm not saying, you know, yeah, we spoil all the time. I'm saying for IMDb to put that as the description.
It's
you know what it reminds me of? John Varley, I think, is the name of the author, wrote a series of books called, the first one was Titan, and I read it, or I listened to it last year, and the description on Audible essentially gave away the MacGuffin of the entire first novel, because it was like people trapped in this you know, essentially rendezvous with Rama, kind of like flying space station. And what they didn't know about the space station was the thing they found out at the very end of it. And it was in the description. And I had figured, because it was in the description and maybe it wasn't that important a plot point, but it was the plot point of the whole goddamn book.
Okay, Rick, stay on target. Enough with your tangents that have nothing to do with Star Trek. That having been said, I agree. I think that IMDb description is way too spoilery. Although, also agree that it doesn't really matter because any Star Trek fan is going to know right away it has something to do with the nebula, because as soon as we see the Renfair dressing, we're not in the holodeck. So it's that kind of episode, and yet not in a holodeck, which is actually innovative in and itself.
So Rick, what did you think of this episode?
Sorry. Like I said, I just had a cup of coffee, so I may be pinging a little bit. I liked it. It was, you know, I expected it to be silly, and it was. It was very clear that the cast were having a ball doing it. What I didn't expect, as I've said in a couple of places online, was for it to absolutely rip my heart out and show it to me still beating as my wife and I fell into a weeping pile on the couch. But in a good way.
In a good way. I'm going to guess, Chris, that you did not like this episode.
I did not like this episode until the last 10 minutes of this episode. And it's strange for me. I was just speaking to one of my fellow Quantum Leap fans, Morgan, about how much we both like in our franchises when you see episodes that are outliers. So like this is almost akin to something like Living Witness on Voyager, or I'm just trying to think of like any kind of episode of a show that you like that takes the familiar characters and turns them around and puts them into a different circumstance. I know Next Gen did this a lot with like Robin Hood and Dixon Hill and all that, but right. I always find it very refreshing, even on shows that I don't like that much. I find it interesting. And this was Strange New Worlds doing that. And usually I really like these kinds of things, even if I'm not a huge fan of the show, because it shakes things up. It shows you like, it's like almost like an Elseworlds or a What If. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't into it for the whole thing, because I don't know if I just don't know this crew well enough yet. So it was too early for this kind of episode. But then if you think like the third episode of every Star Trek is like The Naked Time, which does essentially the same thing. They're right in the wheelhouse of first season Trek. So what really got me with this episode was the father-daughter thing. I know that you guys both have daughters. I was expecting both of you to be quivering wrecks with this. As you know, I don't have children, but in my heart, I have a daughter. I've never met her, and I probably never will. It wasn't so much the little girl part. It was when she came back as an adult. That killed me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, yes.
That yeah. got me. That's See, that got me. Saved me, because yeah. if they had just left it as she was gone, I would have, I don't know that I'd be able to talk about it right now, that she came back. Well, she's like, everything's cool. That was like, okay, thank God.
I agree that it got me. I did tear up when the little girl comes back as an adult and we see that she's fine. Yeah, it got me. I was crying. But then when the episode was over and I was looking back, I was like, that's so cheap. It's so cheap that like it was all wrapped up in a pretty bow, even though I understand it's a fairy tale. It has to end happily ever after. Of course, that makes sense for the tone of the episode. But I still, I don't know, I guess maybe I'm very different from Rick in this. I like the dark episodes. I like it when they're a downer. So I was a bit annoyed that it was just so happy of an ending and such an easily resolved solution to the sick little girl problem.
Well, if you want to just get a little specific, I'm at an age now where my friends who have had daughters, all of their daughters are now in their young 20s, and Same. They are all amazing people. And I like seeing their daughters more than I like seeing my friends.
Okay. Ew.
Because they're just so engaging and so funny. And so they're just great. Like to a person, every one of them is just a giant ball of charm. And God, I wish you were my daughter. And that's what I think, this is what spoke to me in the episode. It's in the place now where I am being childless, seeing my daughter at this point would have been in her 20s. She would have been a college graduate had we had kids when we first got married. So that's maybe why that part of the episode spoke to me specifically now, because that's where I am.
I don't think that part of the episode spoke to you because that's where you are. I think it would have spoken to anyone. Like, I have no kids, but it still got me.
First, I guess I'll say I liked the episode not as much as I have been liking the episodes. Same thing until the last, I give it like 15 minutes or so. Because I also liked, I liked the pacing of it, but the story wasn't that, the storybook story wasn't that engaging to me. Because Robin Hood, you kind of know the story. This is presumably, I mean, I don't know if this is an actual fairy tale from somewhere. I assume they just made it up.
Of course they made it up. Did you not see who the author of the fairy tale is?
And we never saw him read it. We know bits and pieces. We know a couple of characters, and we got the little summary, or not even a summary, a few reference points at the start of the episode. But we don't know what's coming, which isn't bad in and of itself, but in this setup, I think it would have been helpful to the, oh, she's changing the story. Okay, well, we didn't know what it was before. Except that those two characters weren't supposed to meet yet. So that's the one thing that they mentioned, so it's the one thing they changed. I liked the reveal of that it was the daughter. I liked that it was a consciousness to consciousness thing. I didn't dislike any part of it, but I didn't love it as much as I have been loving them until the end, until Himmer uses his wizardry to banish them all to the dark dimension of the cargo bay. And after that, it's a great episode. There were lots of good things throughout the episode too. In my notes, exactly like you said, Chris, I say that this is a holodeck episode without the holodeck.
Yeah,
I pretty much agree with everything you're saying, John, and I think you may be right that there may have been an element of the audience being disserved by not knowing the story beforehand. So it was a reveal to us when the doctor says, like, oh, wait, this is the story's been altered. This isn't quite right. And maybe that would have been stronger if we as the audience also knew that. I'm not sure. I need to think about that, but that's an interesting point.
You know, I usually don't like episodes like this where everybody becomes somebody different. And like you said, Chris, usually they do this right at the beginning where we don't know anyone anyway. I think this one worked a little better for me because we do know these characters better than, like, you know, episode 2 of TOS, which was The Naked Time. I think it was episode 3 of TOS. It was episode 2 of TNG. Maybe 4 or 5 of DS9 when they all got the aphasia virus and stuff. And then, the thing where Sisko built the clock and they all were, you know, it's like, you got to know the characters before you can enjoy them being someone else. And I think we felt we knew these characters well enough that watching them be different, and it wasn't on purpose, like a holodeck thing, you know, Dixon Hill or a Sherlock Holmes or something, they're going in there pretending to be these characters, which is, I always found very cringy. I never liked the holodeck episodes, especially A Fistful of Data's. That one just, yeah.
I very much always did enjoy the holodeck episodes, even though I agree the twist of being that it's a holodeck gone wrong. I mean, it got old really fast. And so I like that they did a holodeck episode without using the holodeck. I quite like that. I like their solution, even though, you know, the idea of a non-corporeal entity being the reveal is not innovative either, but still somehow it's better.
But this was fun, especially Anson Mount. His character was so much fun. But one thing I didn't catch this, so I can't claim any ownership of catching this piece of trivia, but just before we started, someone on the Star Trek shitposting group posted a screen cap. The Elysian Kingdom was written by Benny Russell.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Remember the Deep Space Nine episode? Beyond the Farthest Star?
That's Sisko's alter ego. Oh.
It's real.
It's a fake.
That's great.
So it's now confirmed. It is canon that Benny Russell is a person who at some point existed.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I wish I had seen that.
Now I love the episode. Now it's a top 10.
Agreed. I retract every criticism.
Agreed. The fact that it's written by Benny Russell is somehow makes it so much more powerful, because that brings up so many things. Like, I mean, I guess you could say it's just a little Easter egg, but in universe, in canon, knowing that somehow this person existed in some form it really makes you wonder, like, maybe this is an ancestor of Sisko's that the prophets were actually letting Sisko inhabit, maybe something like that.
I like that that Pike, I mean, you know, his performance is what it was. Like, it's what it called for. Great, fine. And I could tell he was enjoying himself, and everyone was enjoying themselves. I like that he was not cast in the lead. Mm-hmm. I like that he was arguably the most useless character because, you know, it's being told from his daughter's perspective. It's being told from Mbinga's daughter's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, her father's the star. And Pike is this person presumably she's only ever heard about. I don't know if she's met Una. I kind of doubt it, but at least, like, you know, maybe she considers her more of an ally, so she got the cool huntress role. I like that people's personalities didn't match who they played.
I have to assume that it was the alien entity who is casting the roles, because, yeah, I don't think the daughter has met any of these people, because they were all, none of them knew she existed, right? Una was surprised that Mbenga even had a daughter, right? So I think it's more the alien entity that was choosing who was going to be who.
You would think that the Ortega's role would have gone to the chief of security, but instead she was a pretty princess.
That was hilarious, oh, especially with the dog. The dog started licking her.
Her real life dog, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. And
so Runa. So for a second, because she kept calling the dog's name, I was like, did they turn Una into a dog? Because we don't know. We didn't, at that point, we didn't know what was happening. We didn't know the parameters. Like, maybe she turned into a dog, which would have been hilarious. But no, it's just her dog.
That makes a lot more sense, though, because my wife and I were both, when the dog started licking her neck and she didn't react. And I was like, did they? And she was like, do you think they told the dog to do that? Or the dog just, I'm like, I think the dog just did that. But like, if it was just, here, actress, hold this dog, and the dog starts licking, you know, they'd be like, all right, we got to do another take, because you start laughing. But if it's her dog, she just,
it wasn't
like,
just her neck, it was her chest. It was like,
yeah,
it was just licking on her. I was thinking, did they smear Alpo on her chest just to keep the dog from being, you know, disruptive in the scene? It seemed very, yeah.
There's a lot of love there.
Yeah, having visited the actress's Instagram and her dog's Instagram, she has an Instagram account for her dog. I think she's just very much that person. And so her relationship with her dog is just, yeah, very affectionate and very cute.
Oh, actually, let me issue a correction. So the whole show, last episode, the pirate episode, we were calling Dr. Angel's alter ego Dr. Adler. It's actually Dr. Aspen.
I didn't think Adler sounded right, but I'm usually wrong about stuff like that. So,
you know, everyone who listens to the show who is screaming at the podcast, sorry about that.
I just listened to it about 3 hours before we got on mic, and even less, and didn't even occur to me. So I wasn't screaming. I'll scream at other things, but that wasn't one of them.
So what would you say stood out to you about this episode? Like, you already talked about some of the things you liked. What, Rick, was there something that you didn't like about it?
Not really, which is odd. I mean, it was, you know, like I've said many times in the past, something has to be really ham-fistedly telegraphed for me to pick up on it ahead of time. And pretty much everything that happened in this episode was, you know, grossly telegraphed, you know, the pictures, you know, we haven't seen the inside of this book until the first 3 minutes of this episode. So that's going to be someone, and that's going to be someone, and that's going to be someone. But it was so much fun the way they did it. The execution was so much fun that I really enjoyed it. You know, it was clear that I said to my wife, you know, it, not too far in, the Nebula wants them to do something. I was kind of off about that, but you know, I didn't twig that it was, you know, his daughter's you know, his daughter was the blueprint for what they were doing. But it was pretty clear that the Nebula was alive because, you know, Star Trek. And, you know, and this was, you know, once we realized that these were real, you know, everybody was real and it wasn't some dream in Mbenga's head. It became pretty clear that the Nebula was doing it. You know, I like that we finally got to see Hemmer's antenna move. That's kind of bugged me all along, is why his dome, his antenna moved. And
they moved just like they do on Enterprise, which I loved.
Yeah. I agree about Hemmer's antenna. It was nice to see them moving. But apparently the reason that they moved so well in Enterprise is because they actually had animatronics built in. And apparently the moving of the antenna was so loud for the actors playing the Andorians that they actually couldn't hear anything else going on. And so I think it's quite good of them to not use the animatronics for the actor playing Hemmer, since he is blind in real life as well. And so him not being able to hear would have just completely put him at a disadvantage and not be able to play the scenes properly. So it was the right choice not to use animatronics. And I assume when they did move in this instance, it was CGI.
But no, there wasn't anything about this episode that really stood out and bothered me. I just, it was a fun romp.
I did not catch. I figured that there was something in the Nebula. I actually, they got me with many of the twists. I mean, they weren't any really big stakes twists. So like them getting me was just, you know, the plot moving forward. But I did not think that she would be the stone. That was and once they established that she was a stone, what was it? The Mercury stone?
Mercury stone, yeah.
I was like, oh, that's cool. I really should have seen coming that he would have to make a choice, since that's the story.
Yeah.
And I wonder now that I'm saying it out loud, I wonder if she presented this in storybook form instead of just, hey dad, you know, I'm talking to this Nebula and here's what we can do. I wonder if she ran this whole simulation for his benefit so that he could go through the process of getting to that point where he understood that choice. I mean, not that he wouldn't understand it, but as, you know, in her whatever 8-year-old mind, as a way for her to break it to him gently.
That's an interesting hypothesis. I just took it as that is the primary way that they have been communicating in her recent memory through the book, that apparently they've read a dozen times at least. And her only waking moments, her only, I guess, until we hear from the Nebula saying that they sensed that she was lonely in the pattern buffer somehow. But you should think that her entire existence is just bursts of seeing her dad and in rapid succession. And they had, but maybe not, because the medical log that Mbenga gave in the beginning said something to the effect that years have turned into months, have turned into weeks, have turned into hours. I mean, she was basically on the brink of being consumed by whatever disease that she had. So even though she is technically, you know, seeing him only for flashes at a time, this has obviously been going on for the majority of her recent memory. And I think that the book is the only bright spot in her existence at this point. So it was the only way, I think, that she could communicate with him in a way that they both have like a common basis for understanding.
I think it's also, yes, and.
Good podcast.
It's kind of the only way she can, like, someone reading a story to you is a very passive event. You know, you are the audience, you're sitting there and you're, you know, they're doing the thing and you're absorbing the thing. But this way it's more interactive. This way she gets to play back with him.
And she was actually complaining about it for most of the time we've seen her, is, you know, dad, yeah, I'm so sick of this.
And I can't change the story. So, yeah, so this is, so, yeah, all of those things kind of wrapped into one. Let's see, did I make any other notes? Costume department's killing it.
Yeah,
as always. did you notice this whole season? Did you notice that Pike's badge was the command star inverted and made yes. really long?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I don't know if I'm saying, is it Celia or Celia?
Celia.
Celia.
Oh, yeah.
Uhura.
Yeah. Yeah. Uhura. Celia Rose Gooding has become my latest crush. She's my new obsession. I follow her on Instagram. I love everything about her. And if you were going to have a character that was going to play against type, hers to me was the most effective in this one. And maybe it's because of my bias towards her. I think everybody else was just sort of play acting, and without Hemmer and Mbinga, it could have been a disaster until they got to, I guess it was Celia playing, who was Janeway's character in the black and white ones? Was that Chaotica?
Oh, Chaotic. No. Yeah. No, Arachnia. She was
called Arachnia. Arachnia. Very Arachnia. But yeah,
It's not just you. You are correct. your assessment is correct.
Sean warned me that I had to tone it back, or I'd get us canceled. But just wow. Everything about that woman. Wow.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me be. I wasn't talking about that part. I mean, that's not just you either. She is quite attractive, but I mean, in terms of the her portrayal, she, like everyone else, was playing it like a high school assembly performance, pretty much. But she was playing it like, you know, like a Disney movie. Like she was. Mm.
She was chewing the scenery and enjoying every bite of it.
She was the one that sold it to me most. Everybody else, like you said, John, it seemed like they were going through the storybook motions. And you were asking like what we didn't like about it. I concur wholeheartedly with you. The fact that the whole fantasy plot was a distraction more than anything else. And that's where the dramatic turns and the act breaks. It hinged on stuff happening in the kingdom, so to speak, where I didn't really give a crap about the kingdom. I barely understood the dynamics of the Red Guard and the Crimson Queen and what's this and who cares.
I think if we had seen, and actually that could have been a really cool sequence if it had opened with him reading the story to her, but it's spliced together, you know, he's in, you know, she's in different, or not, I guess they wouldn't be in different, but it's clearly different times. But like, you know, he's reading the story, like he's, you know, the story is, you know, but so it's spliced together.
You wanted him to be Peter Falk and her to be Kevin Arnold, or what's the
sure?
Who's the Wonder Years kid? Fred Savage.
Yes, but you know, like almost not stop motion, but almost like time lapse. Mm. So like, you know, so you see that he's reading this same story, but it's happening over, you know, like maybe they got people fast forward walking around the background or whatever. But just enough so that we know what the story is supposed to be. So that we'll know, okay, this is, but as it is, we've got to divert our attention. We can't put the story on autopilot, like a Western or like I almost said Peter Pan, Robin Hood. Or even if it was a familiar story that we already knew, you know, Three Little Pigs, whatever. Because we have to pay attention to the storybook story as they're telling it, it kind of detracts from the Star Trek story while they're trying to figure it out.
See, I didn't have a problem with that. I never felt like anybody was in danger. You know, there were absolutely no stakes in this episode.
No, but I like that it was low stakes. I got really tired with Discovery, that it was always so high stakes, and like, you know, an entire planet is destroyed, and now it's the entire galaxy that's going to be destroyed. Oh no, like, it's the biggest thing ever. It always has to be bigger, 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 like the Star Wars model. And I'm like, I find the Star Trek stories that are better are the ones that are a little bit more scaled back and that are more personal and more about high stakes for individuals, high stakes in terms of what they are going through emotionally. And so a story where, yeah, there wasn't really a sense of danger, except for Mbenga himself and what in his harrowing journey in terms of his daughter. And that's why I thought the ending was a bit cheap, because I almost didn't want it to be wrapped up so easily. I wanted his stakes to be high, the relationship with his daughter to be high stakes. And you could argue that it is a sad ending because he doesn't get to interact with his daughter anymore because she's off doing her own thing. But I mean, I guess that's just a metaphor for the way any parent is with their kid. Eventually you have to let go and let your child go off and do their own thing. So I guess that's what the story's saying. But in terms of it not working because it wasn't high stakes enough, I completely disagree. For me, that worked really well, the fact that it was low stakes, that it was holodeck without them having to like, oh no, the safeties are off for some stupid reason and now we're actually in danger. I don't want them to be in danger. I want them to have a fun romp, but then to be really emotionally impacted by what's going on.
Oh, and one thing, again, I cannot claim to have caught this. I only just, you know, we're doing this far earlier in the week than we almost ever do. It just came out today, so haven't had a whole lot of time to digest the episode, but the Crimson Guard were all red shirts. I didn't catch that until someone mentioned it.
That's good.
Yeah. So like there's little stuff like that, that, you know, really haven't had time to digest. I didn't think that the story was wasn't really all that important. It was the characters, you know, that
I feel like you're making my point.
You are. I am. I'm not disagreeing with you. It just didn't bother me. It didn't even occur to me until you mentioned it. Because I didn't think that the story was particularly of any importance. So it was just, especially once we found out that this was kind of, you know, through the prism of an 8-year-old who has been in communication with this, you know, omniscient cloud being who is trying. And again, this is something we've seen on Star Trek before, where, you know, a timeless being interacts with a child and tries to make reality out of how the child interprets the world, and does a really bad job of it.
Again, first season DS9.
Yeah.
It wishes war versus.
Uh-huh. Or the imaginary friend on TNG.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Good Lord and the Children Shall Lead on TOS. I mean,
that was third season.
Well, yeah, but still. You know, we have precedent for this stuff in Star Trek. So I guess I just sort of went, yeah, whatever. I'm just along for the ride and just watching the characters. And Hammer being absolutely clueless was hilarious too, especially when he tried to play it off, and it was just so awful.
I think that
I loved his performance, because he was, yeah, I think that having the two of them aware of what was going on, but also aware that they had to play along enough, was really well done.
I feel there was a missed opportunity there, because even though they're all, you know, aliens, and this is supposed to be the early days of the Federation, where I guess maybe Andorians, humans, and Vulcans are the, you know, three of the five founding members, I think. I still think that their society would not be homogenized enough where Hemmer should be expected to know the tropes of like fantasy fiction.
Which I is why he did such a bad job of it.
But the thing is, he didn't ask about any of the conventions. What the hell is this? He sort of rolled with it in a way that he almost sort of knew the conventions. I really wish that they had he's an Aenar. He lived in a freaking ice cave for his whole life until he went to Starfleet. What does he know? Everything to him is the shadow on the wall, even though he's blind, but not to mix my metaphors. You know, this is a deeply human story.
Okay, but he's read a book before. He's obviously very familiar with the work of seminal author Benny Russell. So he was able to roll with the punches. I actually thought they hit the right note with Hemmer, because he was obviously having a great time. he's usually such a hard ass in his real life, if you will, in engineering. And so having the opportunity to really have fun was great. It was great to see that side of his personality. And I don't think it's unbelievable that an Einar would know some little bit about the conventions of human fairy tales. That didn't bother me. And, you know, he asked about what's the right word to say, and then he gets the response abracadabra, and then he goes with it. So I think that was enough of a little indication that he's not completely familiar, but familiar enough.
I don't think his performance indicated any sort of knowledge of any of that. He asked one question because he's like, okay, so what would a wizard say right now? And so he asked him, and then he told him, okay, well, I'm doing a wizard thing, so abracadabra. I like it. That was it. Like, that's all he needed to know. I don't feel like he...
I'm not saying it didn't work. I'm just saying I thought that was a missed opportunity.
Maybe he was in the room when they were watching a Danny Kaye movie, and he heard some of it.
Right, the flagging with the dragon?
Exactly.
The chalice with the palace, yeah. But, yeah, I think that was a weakness. And the other thing that they could have done, and TOS would have done, when Una came in as the archer, the mistress of the woods or whatever, she straight up murdered like three people with her arrows. Mm-hmm. Now, if you recall, Mbinga was going to the bridge because Ortegas hit her head and he was going to help her. So did the nebula heal her? And yes. At some point that it would have been like the third act break where, you know, the doctor would have leaned over those three crewmen that were shot with the arrows and said, they're dead, Jim. And they would have had the sting and it would have gone to commercial.
I don't think she murdered anyone with her arrows. I think she was just perhaps piercing their armor. And then maybe the entity was knocking them out. Like, I think it was quite clear that the entity was not letting anyone get injured. Because right off of the bat, that the show starts with Ortegas getting injured. And then next thing we know, she's totally fine. So the entity healed her. The entity healed the little girl. I never got the sense that there was any danger. And I felt it was clear that the entity was keeping people alive, even if they were being injured in story.
If you wanted to give the act breaks some stakes, show not just that they're in this fantasy realm, this pseudo reality, but that, oh wait, we could all still die.
No, no more dying red shirts. Not to beat a dead horse, but I like that the stakes were low and I don't want anyone to die. Well, I'm not saying I don't want anyone to die ever in the show. I just mean for the tone of this particular episode, I like that they didn't go the TOS or TNG route and have like, oh my God, they're dead. Oh no, this is so scary all of a sudden. I like that it was kept relatively low key. And Mbenga still mentioned like, you know, we got to move this along before someone gets hurt. Like he was still worried, but I'm glad that it never got so dire that he's all of a sudden, you know, dripping in anxiety because people are actually dying.
I disagree with you. I disagree. I don't think you're wrong, but I don't want those stakes. Because a lot of times I feel like, especially on Star Trek, they'll do that. They'll kill somebody just to show, oh, see, it's deadly.
Oh, I'm not saying, and there would have been a reset button at the end.
Well, and the captain was
like Spectre of the Gun. You know, it would have, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the nebula heals everybody. But even to do... I feel it always feels like a I don't know, a pagan sacrifice to me for the sake of story, a pagan sacrifice on the altar of the story. There's a thing, and you know, red shirt gets killed by the thing. Okay, so the thing is really dangerous. You didn't need to kill red shirt. Like he's
you gotta kill red shirt back later. You've seen Star Trek, right? You gotta kill red shirt.
You don't have to kill Red Shirt. I want a kindler, gentler Star Trek.
We're on the same page, John.
Listen, that guy wore a red shirt. He knew what he was in for.
This is before Star Trek. He didn't know.
Check me on this. The woman with the scar on her face. Had we seen her before?
She was the helmsman.
No.
The navigator. Oh, well, you're right. Yes, okay, she was the one at the helm at the beginning.
Yeah, she's not the helmsman. She's a navigator. We've seen her sitting next to Ortega.
Okay. Yeah, so I actually looked her up. Rong Fu is the name of the actor, and she played Jenna Mitchell. Jenna Mitchell is the name of her.
I know I'm messing up the timeline here, but I always see her as Demora Sulu. I just do every time I see her.
That's because you're racist.
Who?
Sulu's daughter, who had a brief appearance in Generations.
Yeah, who wouldn't be born for another 20 years?
For another 100 years. And yeah, at first, I didn't recognize her with the makeup. I was like, who is it? Is that Ming-Na Wen? Did they bring back Hoshi? Is that Hoshi? And then I realized, no, that's why she looks familiar, because she was just at the helm.
She was just there.
I just wanted it to be Linda Park. It doesn't mean that it will be Linda Park. I just always wanted it to be Linda Park. That's all.
Jesus, all Asian women are the same person to you? Christ, I was just joking with the racist comment, and now I'm like, ah.
So back to what you were saying about Uhura, I was going to say something, because like she wasn't in the last two episodes. And I was like, where has Uhura been? And then I had to remind myself, she's a cadet in this series.
She's on rotation.
Yeah, so she's on rotation. So she would, I think, pretty much both of the most recent episodes were on the bridge almost exclusively, and with the one that where Rises Up, where whatever was on the planet or on the bridge. So it made sense that she wasn't around. But then, wow, like you said, they brought her back with a vengeance in this one. And the last two episodes were also very chapel heavy. There's been a great meme going around of basically variations on "I have an army, well, we have a nurse chapel," which I love. I think Jess Bush has become one of my favorite actors, one of my favorite people. If you do any research about her, she's just an amazing person. But I love chapel, but I've missed Uhura. And in this episode, they kind of flipped the script. We had 30 seconds of chapel being very toned down. And then Uhura just, busting forth, and it was great.
This was the first episode where I really felt an affinity for Ortega. I think that the role that they cast her in was the most grounded and convincing of the transformations that I saw until Rebecca walked in as the archer. I thought that, and then they had that little tete-a-tete where they were together. I liked both of them in it. As much as I loved Celia, I'm never going to say it right, being over the top, deliciously over the top, they were sort of the only thing that grounded this. And I know that everybody's working against type and all that. Anson Mount was wasted in this episode. I don't think any of the turns of his character were particularly funny or interesting. It was just, oh, look, it's the brave captain being the coward. Okay, that joke wore thin about 40 seconds into the transformation.
I like that his hair is basically a character at this point. It's just his own entity. So, there's big, tall Captain Pike hair, and there's tussled, tortured pirate prisoner hair, and split down the middle, Peabody, the cowardly advisor hair.
The funny thing is, as is often the case with you and I, Chris, I'm completely 180 degrees from you on Ortegas. I thought her portrayal as the character, whatever, sir, whatever, she was the weak link.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't buy it for a second. And she kept pulling her sword out. Like,
you know what? I guess because now this goes to where I see her in sort of the entire Star Trek lexicon. Mm-hmm. The character to me is not so much interesting because she's still just a cipher. She's just a snork machine at the helm. Mm-hmm. But I feel like her personality lends itself to be someone like a Tasha Yar, but interesting.
Yeah.
And in this circumstance, that was sort of realized. Is that valid? Do you think a good interpretation?
Absolutely. I just...
You see more actual personality, even though it was a fake personality.
It's definitely valid. It's so interesting to see how divergent everyone's opinions are about each individual cast member and how they are in general on the show, but how they are in this particular episode where they're playing against type, or most of them are, or that they're at least doing something a little bit different. For me, I just went with it. and I liked all of them. I thought Ortegas was great. I thought Pike was hilarious. You know, yes, he's maybe it's a bit embarrassing what he was doing, and I can definitely see a lot of people being annoyed by that because they're like, Pike is meant to be the star of the show and he's meant to be the hero, so having him become this big loser coward is disrespectful. I thought it was hilarious, and I thought Anson Mount was having a great time. The only one for me that didn't work was actually Una, because I thought her Huntress was too similar to number one. And so that to me was, I guess, that was the missed opportunity for me to have Una do something a little bit outside the box. But everyone else worked for me.
I have to give a caveat when I say, like, you know, like people like, the guy that plays Captain Jack Sparrow, not Captain Jack Sparrow, Captain Jack Harkness.
John Barrowman.
Everything I've seen about him, I would love to hang out with the dude. I would love to do a show with the guy. I have never seen him give a performance as an actor, as opposed to like doing a musical performance. I've never seen him do any actual acting that I thought was any good. There's just, and I think that's just an occupational hazard because of my job. You know, I'm a hard audience. I'm a really difficult audience. And sometimes there are some acting things that just totally turn me off. And I'm not saying that makes them bad actors. It's just things that I don't buy. And I didn't buy Ortegas as that character.
As you said, we're 180 degrees. The only thing that got me to watch modern Doctor Who, and it's not because I don't like it, I just fell off from it. I was front and center when Captain Jack came back. I absolutely love that character. He's my favorite character. So everything John Barrowman does, I'm a fan.
Now there are a couple of wonderful videos of him doing his apparently he just tours doing show tunes. And
he does a lot of it in drag too.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
That sounds
right. Yeah. There's this wonderful one. Well, he sings the song I Am What I Am from Lacage, and it's so fabulous. And you're just like standing up in front of your goddamn computer applauding. He's just so great at it.
Did you watch Arrow?
I watched like the first four episodes, and I saw his first episode and I was like, oh God.
I don't agree with that at all. I also love Captain Jack, and I thought he was really good on Arrow.
And I know I'm in a huge that's an oxymoron. I know I'm in the minority, a very teeny minority.
Oh no, there were some episodes of Torchwood where I was just like, they must be embarrassed by this. They have to be.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I think that Barrowman is the kind of actor where you expect a certain amount of cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's able to pull it off.
I can take him in small doses.
I mean, the point is just that it's entirely subjective. We've all got actors/characters who either do or do not work for us. So one of the things for me that I really enjoy about Strange New Worlds is there's actually not a single character on there who greatly annoys me. I do think Ortegas is too snarky, but I still like her. And so there's no one that I find myself hating. Whereas every other series in the Star Trek franchise, there's at least one character who really grates on my nerves. And so it's really refreshing, actually, to have a show where I finally like everyone.
I don't feel like Barrowman was really the whole problem with Torchwood.
No.
I don't even know if he was the biggest problem with Torchwood. There were quite a few issues.
However, we digress.
But we digress. At the end when she faded away and the camera just held on him, I was like, oh my God. But I'm already headcanoning. Oh, they'll come back in second season, and she, you know, they'll come back. Of course, he's going to come back to visit. Why wouldn't he come back to visit? But no, the fact that she came back as and just came back as a young woman, that was chef's kiss. Perfect. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Well, it's no surprise that I was crying. I mean, it's, you know, I bawl at commercials now, but we're sitting there watching it, and I hear my wife sniffling, and I'm like, I just grabbed a tissue and added it.
You know, it's funny.
For a second, I thought it was like, she's been in the holodeck so long, and this is the age that she would have been if she wasn't just constantly put in stasis. But I was like, no, she didn't, it wouldn't be that long. It wouldn't, but no.
Benga's not been that old.
Yeah, no. I'm sorry, because she was saying.
No, just to go to the point where you said you were watching with your wife, Rick. Right. At the risk of repeating myself to Quantum Leap podcast fans, there were sometimes, we were talking about this when the Dr. Ruth episode came into the rotation. I'm very glad that I'm a solitary science fiction consumer in my home and that my wife doesn't watch half the stuff that I do, because there are sometimes episodes where it's just so cringeworthy. And even though you're a diehard fan and you love it and you'll die on that hill, it's still kind of embarrassing to be watching it. And this episode skirted that for me, especially when they had La'an as the princess and doing the song. And it was just like, thank God Laura's at work tonight, because if she was sitting here, I would just be like, don't look at me. Look away. Just go get out of the room.
Yeah, do not be ashamed of your franchise. Don't be embarrassed by the cringy episodes. This is great. You're a Star Trek fan and you must own up to it. And you must defend it.
Hey, see, we both started laughing our asses off when we were like, I thought it was going to be Una when we just saw the silhouette and the dress. I was like, oh, look what they did. And then we realized it was La'an, and we both started laughing our asses off because that was just so perfect.
Yeah.
It's purposely cheesy and it speaks to the fans because the fans love it. But you have to realize when you're outside of your fan context, it's kind of embarrassing. That's all.
Yeah. Much like all fandom.
Yeah.
You know, me wearing a Pikachu shirt in the right context, it's fine. But, you know, I'm trying to hang out with my middle-aged friends, like my wife's work friends. It's not the move.
Right.
I did not look up any trivia, like Rick said.
I tried. There isn't any yet.
Yeah, it just hasn't happened. It hasn't happened yet. Which is this episode's hot off the press.
Well, that Benny Russell thing was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, that was sweet.
For sure. I think that's all I've got. We've certainly got more time if you guys want to continue to talk, but I don't know if I have anything else.
There's one thing that we didn't touch upon that really was a pleasant surprise to me. When I saw the previews for this, I only saw them in the costumes. And I don't really watch, like John, I don't watch coming up next because I don't want to be spoiled. And I can't stomach the Ready Room. So I was really expecting them to go like full period, full Game of Thrones with this because of the costumes that I saw. But I loved the twist that they were still on the ship. Mm-hmm. The ship was still manifestly the ship with just some medieval trappings draped around it. And it was one of the most creative, even though it was probably the cheapest thing. Like this is plastic plants that you could get at Home Goods to make a bottle show. That was probably one of the most creative bottle shows that I've ever seen.
And this is the point in the season where they usually need to save some money. So
yeah.
It all worked.
It was a perfect use for a bottle. So it was one of the best bottle shows I've ever seen creatively. And the other part of this is, I don't know if we're just not seeing part of engineering, but if you guys recall, there was a Short Treks, which I thought was one of the weakest of the Short Treks, where they had the cadet
Short Treks. I knew what you were talking about.
They had the prisoner.
Yeah.
And it turned out the prisoner was Pike.
Yeah.
And at the end of the Short Treks, they took this cadet down to engineering.
Oh, right.
And the engineering of the, you know, 1701, no bloody A, B, C, had a vertical warp core and looked just like every other freaking warp core you've ever seen. And I was like, no, I hated it. But I'm loving the fact that they've now gone with the horizontal warp core, apparently evocative of TOS. But it's just the greatest thing about the redesign of of the Big E for me for this series. I love the scope that they've given engineering, but it still holds on to everything I loved about, you know, the original design of TOS. I have been a vocal, I don't know about critic, but I'm just disappointed that the inside of the Enterprise in this doesn't look enough like the Enterprise to me. As soon as they get to engineering, I'm like, now I'm starting to get it. And I'm just so glad that either they're not showing that vertical warp core or they just did away with it because they realized it doesn't fit in with the aesthetic of TOS, which is obviously what they're trying to mimic here or update anyway.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but you're right.
For me, it's the Jeffries tube. I love that they once again reused that super TOS Jeffries tube as like the secret tunnel that Dark Wizard Spock leads them through.
You know, something I really got a kick out of was, and it had to be intentional because they could have used any other set. The prison was the transporter room.
Mm-hmm.
The irony that they were imprisoned in something that if they could have just gotten to the controls, beamed themselves out of it.
Think about where the daughter was trapped. Of course that's the prison.
Oh, wow.
Ooh. Of course that's the prison. It's the one place she can't leave.
Dude.
I didn't even think about that. That's great.
Yeah. I thought it was just the designers going, hey, this is great. No, that's perfect.
No, that was basically a stab in the heart. It was just like, wait a minute, this is the place she hates the most.
Okay. That didn't even occur to me.
So this is the 8th of 10 episodes this season.
Mm-hmm.
This series is famously serialized. So usually on a Star Trek show, these, you know, past couple of years, like, so how are they going to wrap this up? How are they going to wrap that up? I don't really know if there's anything to wrap up in terms of a season long arc. Like his daughter might have been it. And they didn't necessarily have to wrap that up this season. They did, but I'm just down for just two more individualized episodes.
No, they've gone out of their way to not to keep everything self-contained. I don't think there's anything to wrap up, but they may give us a cliffhanger for the finale. I wouldn't be surprised at that.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I gotta be honest. I mean, if we're doing like final thoughts, I'm so glad that we're done with the daughter subplot. It was one of the weakest parts of the show to me because it just didn't seem to make much sense. Why would he keep her imprisoned in the transporter? It was problematic from the beginning, just from the point of view of this is what you're doing to a child. I know that you have noble intent. And then to make something that monumental into a side plot that's over here, that sometimes we see the doctor lamenting the fate of his daughter. I'm so glad that they got this thorny, sort of gross, very uncomfortable story beat out in a way that makes me care about the doctor much more than I have up until this point. Because I was thinking, he's likable, but what the hell is he doing? It's kind of monstrous. It's so monumentally selfish. So the fact that he was able to set her free at the end of this episode was a redemption for me.
I never saw it that way, but I get it. I could absolutely see how you see it that way. And I guess because I knew that she was going to be okay. I didn't know how or when. So, and I guess I can't say I knew, but I, you know, had faith that Star Trek was going to Star Trek it.
Was it faith of the heart?
It's been a long road, John.
Well, we're getting from there to here. Rick, why don't you talk about where you can find where they can find you?
Well, just real quick. I agree with you, Chris, on that. Not necessarily for the same reasons. I didn't think what he was doing was horrible. I just thought it made no sense because, you know, okay, this is a little bit of a nitpick. And it's retconning some stuff I'm going to have to
reprogram. The Enterprise, and we've talked about this before, the Enterprise until the Enterprise D was not the flagship of the fleet. Pike said last week that this Enterprise is the flagship of the fleet. So I'm like, all right, so now we're back to that. The chief medical officer of the flagship of Starfleet can't pull strings and get the best specialists in the Federation to work on his daughter. He's got to carry her around in a suitcase in the back room of his office.
Actually, part of me thought that's where they were going to go with this, that that the moral of the story would be that you can't do this, you can't solve this problem on your own, and it would be like the Nebula would, like, my theory anyway was that the Nebula was connecting all of their minds, and they were, when I thought that he was controlling the story, or it pulled him, you know, it pulled the storybook from him, that basically use like the internet hive mind to super think and come up with a solution. And the research that you know, dude from the super advanced child torture planet dropped, that they didn't mention at all. Nope. I'm like, that just happened. And it's clearly relevant to this story. Like, just a line. Why wouldn't you just say, you know, it has some promising leads, but nothing concrete, and not in, it's, I won't have enough time. I won't have enough time. I'm running out of time.
You know what just dawned on me? That whole him being incredibly unprofessional and keeping his face over the petri dish while he dumped the chemical into the other chemical and it blew up in his face. That was, you know, did not, that was nothing to do with absolutely nothing to do with the story.
Complete red herring. I was waiting for it to come into play. I was waiting for it to come into play. Yeah.
That was red herring gum that he inhaled.
Anyway, you can find me on Starbase 66 or Open the Iris or this show or Cosmic Potato, the Super Fan Talk podcast, or occasionally on Captain Game Show.
And Chris.
You can find me on the Quantum Leap podcast at quantumleappodcast.com, where Rick will never appear because he's never watched the show.
I can't say never, but I haven't watched it since it was on the air.
You're always potentially welcome if I okay. Well,
I appreciate that.
I have watched the show, and I do listen to every episode of the Quantum Leap podcast you put out.
And John has been on the podcast. So.
Have I? Suck oh, up. Yeah. Well, that wasn't like an episode discussing
it. It was a better episode.
It was great fun.
And thank you, Neek. Where can folks find you?
You can find me at superanemic.com, where I post my Star Trek recaps. I recap all the new shows except for Lower Decks, because that one is just for me. It's not work. And I also, when there's no new Star Trek coming out, I also recap the old Star Trek shows. And I also cross-post everything to Facebook, so you can find them there as well.
So next week's episode number 9, as I'm sorry. Huh?
Number 9?
He's doing a Beatles thing. Just move on.
I'm old. We're old.
I'm sorry, Sean, that I am the one who gets to say it is the penultimate episode. I know it's your favorite word ever. Episode number 9, season 1, All Those Who Wander, will air on June 30th. I've not looked at a description. I've not looked at a description because that would be a spoiler, and we know how I do. But when it airs, we will be here to discuss it, as we do, same thing we do every week, Pinky. As for me, you can find me often, but not always on this show, often not always on Cosmic Potato, the Super Fan Talk podcast, but invariably hosting my trivia wordplay game show, Captain Game Show, also on this network. My intention was to listen to what Sean says at the end and then write it down and repeat it. I did none of those 3 things.
You did.
But I hope, regardless, dear listeners, we will be here for the next episode of Star Trek. And I hope that you will be here for the next episode of that Star Trek podcast.
Remember, Star Trek podcast.
Nope.